Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am Rabbi Richard Address, your host, the director of Jewish Sacred Aging. Welcome and really thank you very, very much for joining us today. These podcasts hope to explore some of the issues related to our own aging and the implications of the revolution and longevity for our families and community. And of course, we continue to welcome your comments and suggestions. And if you feel to do so, please contact me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And we invite you also to visit our website, Jewish Sacred Aging, on Facebook. And without further ado, it's a great pleasure and honor to welcome a friend and colleague to this week's edition of Seekers of Meaning, Rabbi Kerry Olitsky, probably best described as a Renaissance rabbi, author, scholar, raconteur, scholar in residence. Kerry, hi, how are you? Good to see you.
Good, how are you? Glad to be with you.
Fine, and as we were talking before we went on the air, we can play dueling libraries because the way things are. I don't know about your books. I think my books at night mate, because in the morning you come in, there seems to be more books than the night before. Your career has spanned a lot of various interesting aspects, and some of which I want to get into. But I want to focus right now on something that's really important, I think, to those of us who have joined the Grandparent Club. And that is you started a new type of authorship. So talk to me about Avi and Ahmed playing football.
Sure. Over the last couple of years, I decided to pivot much of my writing energy to writing children's books. And I think it was probably motivated by the blessing of seven grandchildren and some of the needs that emerged. And as I saw them being raised by their parents and also the society around them. In particular, this book emerges, not only from my wife's work in creating the Sisterhood of Salaam Shalom, which over the years has grown to an international organization, but also this particular book emerges from a trip that I took pre-COVID. It was a multi-faith trip to Israel. And with us were Christians, Jews, and Muslims. And while we were in Israel, we also experienced from very different perspectives the life of Christian, Jews, and Muslims in the land of Israel. And when I came back, I decided that since I had been working in the area of children's literature for the last couple of years, that this was a perfect area to try to concentrate our energies, because it's clear that lots of the attitudes that emerge among adults start when they are children. And those children often get their attitudes about other people from their parents. So that if I could create a number of children's books that were focused on the issue of Jews and Arabs, Jews and Muslims, Christians and Jews getting together in the context of Israel, and working together, living together harmoniously, then I would be able to achieve something. So this particular book, because football, which we in the United States call soccer, where football becomes such a major cultural influencing factor in Israel, it seemed to me, especially for the two lead characters in this book, Avi and Ahmed, that it made sense to bring them together in a way that demonstrates that these are friends, that they've transcended the political environment that they may find themselves, etc. And that's really came. And so one of my co-author for this particular book, Inas Yunus, is a person who, she's a Muslim woman, lives in Kansas City, and we got to know each other. We had known each other before, but got to know each other even better during this trip, and decided, because she was also a writer, mostly a journalist, that it made sense for us to work together. And this is actually one of three publications that are in the pipeline that focus on these kinds of issues. This happens to be about two young boys in Jerusalem.
Talk to me about this collaboration, because I think it's that in itself, I think, with Miss Eunice is an interesting story. You traveled with her, you knew her, but in the process of you co-authoring this book, I would were there a series of interesting conversations that you had to process with her, or vice versa, about what happens to Avi and Ahmed?
Yes. I mean, I did know her before. I met her again through my wife's organization, the Sisterhood of Salaam Shalom. And we got to know each other. So before the trip started, I already knew her, had a relationship with her. And we experienced these things. I think that the fact that both of us lean left with regard to Israel and relationships between Muslim and Jews allowed us to both open ourselves up to conversations and how to deal with various issues, recognizing that if we confronted something that was a Muslim question, I deferred to her. And if it was something that was a Jewish question, she deferred to me, whether it was guiding the illustrator, whether it was a particular language issue, whether it was how we wanted to frame the conversation or whatever. Even simple questions like, should the mother of the young boy in the story, Ahmed, should she cover her head? And would Avi, the Jewish boy, would he have a head covering, a kippah, yarmulke, or not? Those kinds of questions we had to deal with in terms of the conversation, as we also navigated this because the trip was pre-COVID. So we started writing in the midst of COVID. So everything was done long distance. Everything was done either online, through email, through telephone conversations, et cetera. And that, of course, added to the difficulty of doing it, but we were able to do it.
You know, in listening to you and understanding the theme of this, I always remember the South Pacific song, You Have to Be Taught How to Hate, and with kids and everything. So real fast, the technical stuff, because this is obviously a possibly wonderful gift for grandchildren.
Absolutely.
So is this available on Amazon? Is it in bookstores? Talk to me about that. How is there a website that you go to?
Sure. There are a number of ways to access the book. And one of the things that's really interesting, which I love about the book, is that a publisher in Great Britain called Dixie Books actually picked it up. And one of the things that's interesting about their business model is that they sell language rights because they're positioned in London. They sell language rights across Europe. And so what's fascinating about this book is, although we wrote it in English and the illustrators from South America, the potential for this to be translated into numerous languages and therefore get into the hands of lots of different people is possible. But because it's from London and shipping costs are always expensive, you can order it directly from the publisher, which is dixiebooks.com, dixibooks.com. But you can also order it from the bookdepository.com, which is a worldwide book distribution system, which does not charge shipping charges anywhere in the world. And so, yes, you can get it on Amazon. Yes, you can get it in the local bookstore. The easiest way to access it is directly online from either the publisher or from the bookdepository.com.
So picking up on what you just said, because this could be very, very important. Do you have knowledge of this being translated into Hebrew?
Or not Arabic? Yet. Not yet. But I hope that will happen. So there are lots of different opportunities for it to happen, but I don't have that knowledge yet.
Without divulging everything, I mean, can you just tell us a little bit about what happens to Avi and Ahmed? And what's the message here? What's the message here of this book?
Sure. Avi and Ahmed are like two little boys. One comes from West Jerusalem. The other comes from East Jerusalem, a community called Silwan, which is in the news all the time because of the challenges of the neighborhood. And so there are subtle references throughout the book without being explicit about the political environment that they come from. They get to know each other. They become friends over football. And it's time for Avi's birthday party at one of the local parks. And Ahmed doesn't show up. And Avi and his family draw conclusions about why he doesn't show up. Is it because he doesn't want to be with all the Jewish friends and family? Is it because he had a difficulty coming from one part of Jerusalem to another? Well, it turns out that he hurt himself playing football, and therefore he was at the doctor, and that's why he couldn't come to the party. And they remain friends and start practicing. And there's an introduction of humor as well, because as one of the things that happens in the party, Avi's cousin comes from the United States, brings him a present, and says, I'm going to bring you a football because I heard you were such a football fanatic, a football player, and it turns out to be an American football. And Avi thinks that that his cousin is playing a joke on him. Because, it's not a football, but it is.
So this message of friendship and everything, I mean, is this in the children's books you're writing? Is this a major thrust? For example, I think you have one coming out in September, a mystery, the Candyman mystery. Is that theme of human encounter and friendship, is that also in there?
It's on a different level. The Candyman mystery, which is being published by Colony Oat, which is a new Jewish imprint, and this will be my second book with them. The first one was called The Littlest Candle. This happens to be about a candy man. And I don't know about your synagogues, but my synagogues, there were always somebody who was giving out candy to the kids. And we used to call him the candy man. In some cases, it would be the candy woman. Whether it's Friday night or Saturday morning, there was always somebody doing this. So in this particular case, an older man, he happens to be a Russian immigrant Jew, and he is befriended by all the kids in the congregation, gives out candy. Well, one Saturday morning in the synagogue, he doesn't show up, and the kids are really concerned. They don't know what to do. They go around the synagogue, they ask, where is he, et cetera, et cetera. Lo and behold, the only one who has the information is the rabbi of the synagogue, and he tells him that, unfortunately, the candy man is in the hospital. And so the kids go to visit the candy man, and that's where they find him, and they give him candy as bringing the sweetness of Shabbat to him. So it is a different kind of friendship, but it certainly is about friendship. It's about the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, of visiting the sick. It's all of these kinds of things in very subtle ways, because none of the books that I've written for children have kind of the in-your-face educational pedagogy, all of those kinds of approaches. Instead, it's a very subtle message that is perfect for either the person reading the book, the parent or caregiver or grandparent who's reading the book to the child to be able to discuss.
Kerry, you have a long and distinguished career of writing some, books around text and major issues, which we want to get to in a minute. Is it harder to write a children's book?
Yes. It's kind of like the issue of writing a sermon. It's much easier to speak for an hour than it is to speak for 10 minutes. And it's the same thing. Children's books, generally speaking, are minimally 300 to 400 words and maximally 1,000 to 1,200 words. So to be able to tell an entire story in fewer than 1,000 words, that's one thing. The second thing is that because what you're doing is painting word pictures, every time we write for children, we have to imagine what the illustrator is going to do in terms of illustrating the words. Is there more action in a sentence that an illustrator can capture? Because you imagine in one sentence or one paragraph, there's one action taking place. The second thing is that it's a much more competitive field, because everybody thinks that, oh, well, I can write 1,000 words. That's no big deal. And so it's very competitive in that regard as well. But it is much more difficult, I find. In some respects, it's much more rewarding as well.
Yeah, so you mentioned the word pictures. So in children's books, and you alluded to this before, the importance of the illustrator. Who has to obviously take your words and then paint that picture on a page so that 5-year-old or whatever can look at the words, but also see. So could you just, it's fascinating, the collaborative aspect, and you probably had to also do this long distance. Your illustrator, you said, was from South America?
Right, so, on this particular book.
Yeah, so could you just, how was it? You were, in essence, you're here in Jersey, your co-author's in Kansas City. And the illustrator is in South America.
And the publisher's in London.
And the publisher's in London. So you have the four corners, multi-continents. How difficult was it just to put this all together?
It is difficult because you have additional barriers as well. First of all, the illustrator's first language was not English, and she was neither Muslim nor Jewish. So you had both a cultural issue, and you have another issue as well with regard to culture, language, etc. And so one of the things that we had to do was be very careful about providing her with pictures, photographs of things that we wanted to imagine. And then we also had to imagine things like, I'll give you a simple issue. In one of the parts of the text, there's a question as to when it's time for the boys to go back home at the end of the day playing. And so they did, the language suggests that when the call to prayer, Muslim prayer, emerges, that's when it's time to finish their play because Ahmed has to go home. So we had to imagine in our own minds where we would hear and what we would see in terms of the minaret of the mosque, the prayer tower. And so could we, in this case, Sacher Park in Jerusalem, could we see a mosque or something else from that and then direct the illustrator as to what it would have to look like? And that was part of the challenge. And then there were also obviously cultural issues that we had to explain and the like as well. But in many cases, if there's an art director, some of that is being handled by an art director. But otherwise, we have to give the illustrator very specific guidance in terms of the illustrations.
You know, the way you're painting this, this collaborative effort between London, New Jersey, Kansas City, South America, I almost can see a video like, how we put this book together with interviews of all of you, just sort of like, you know, because it itself is a metaphor for the book in many ways, even though it's a children's book. But
of course,
look, many of the children's books we used to read and still read, we understand that they're really for us too. But this is you've actually lived the message of the book in this collaboration and cooperation between cultures and individual. So kol hakavod. I mean, it's really,
thank you.
That's really cool. That's really cool. And so once again, Dixi, D-I-X-I, right? Not D-I-X-I books.com.
Correct.
And the other one, book depository.
The book depository.com.
Okay. You've pioneered in many cases in parts of your career a series of books and scholar in residences and discussions and articles around everything from interfaith marriages and the welcoming of interfaith, et cetera, and addiction and recovery. And I want to just explore some of that with you, if you don't mind.
Of course.
First of all, did any of that in any way, shape, or form in your adult book, let's put it that way, did they have any influence on the subjects or that you chose for the children's books?
No, most of the children's books emerge out of the experiences that I've had. For example, I have one coming out later this year from a small publisher in Alaska called Relevant Publishing, which is the story of a young child who goes to Alaska and they try to figure out in the summertime when it doesn't get dark, when does Shabbat end? You can't see when the stars come out, et cetera. And this was simply, I studied the issue academically, but this was the first time I really had to consider it practically when we were in Alaska. So I came back and I said to myself, you know, I think that there's a storyline there. And that's how that developed. And there are other books that develop storylines as well. So it's mostly about those kind of personal experiences that emerge as topics for the books.
Are you still involved in any way, shape, or form with the recovery movement, or the Jewish recovery movement? I know you've written and spoken about this in previous incarnations of life. And books.
Yeah, most of it is reactive rather than proactive. I would suggest that early in my career, most of the work in recovery was very proactive in terms of seeking out those opportunities in which I could be of help to people, institutions, organizations, speaking and the like. Now it's reactive. So it's very common for, especially rabbinic colleagues, to reach out to me and ask me for help, referrals, recommendations, would I speak to somebody, et cetera, as opposed to being proactive.
The Pew reports that came out a couple of years ago and the one that came out in last month in May really indicate the, I guess I'm searching for a good word, so I'll just say the institutionalization in the normative American Jewish community, at least in the non-Orthodox community, of interfaith marriage and the challenges of congregations and communities welcome these individuals and the impact. You've written a lot about that. You had Big Tent Judaism. You really were a pioneer in many of these areas. I'd love to know your reaction to some of these now new statistics and things that are coming out. And it seems that the revolution that was started in when Alex, of blessed memory, Rabbi Alex Schindler in 1978 gave that speech in Houston, launching the outreach program, that we're really in a very, very different world. Could you just react to some of these things in your opinion, since you have been involved in this for many, many years?
Sure. I think that, to quote Lyndon Johnson, President Lyndon Johnson, who used to use the term American, I think we've become fully American, as he used to say. And I think that that's really what's happened across the sociological plane. And so what's basically happened now, and I would bracket the last 4 years with regard to the increases of anti-Semitism and the like, because we really don't know where that's going to take us. But I would say, essentially, what has changed is not the willingness of Jews to marry those of other faiths, but the willingness of those of other faiths to marry Jews. And that's really what has changed as American Jews have become part of the fabric of the American community. Then there is no difference. And I would argue, in terms of synagogues and rabbis, that the false dichotomy between those who are unmarried and those who are intermarried needs to be replaced with the dichotomy of, if you will, those who are engaged by the Jewish community, the organized Jewish community, and those who are not engaged by the organized Jewish community. Because those who are engaged, especially in liberal circles, whether they're unmarried or intermarried, look a lot alike. And those who are not engaged by the organized community, whether they're unmarried or intermarried, look a lot alike. And so the disconnect is between engagement. And one of the things that's important is, as the community has become part of the marketplace and Jewish ideas are now part of the marketplace of ideas, we have to realize that Jewish community institutions are not the only access points for people who want to engage Jewishly. And so, in a sense, I think synagogues and other communal institutions have to turn themselves inside out if they want to reach anybody. And I think that, ironically, one of the things that COVID has taught us is we have to do things that we were forced to do that we should have been doing a long time ago, and that is providing multiple access points for people in terms of Judaism writ large and Jewish communal institutions.
Yeah, I'm glad you said it, because in the consultations I'm doing with some congregations vis-a-vis our work in Jewish sacred aging, we keep pointing out, look, you've reached more people through COVID in your Zoom sessions, your Zoom services, the Zoom high holidays, whatever you want to call it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to go back to, you think if you're going to go back to the way it was in December of 2019, if you do that, you'll be out of business in a generation or probably 5 years.
Right.
And this, it's interesting because you know congregations as well. There's some hesitancy to really say, oh, okay, we really have to blow everything up and look at it through totally different lenses, as opposed to, okay, let's survive this and we'll go back. Because I don't think everybody's running back to the synagogue, the building.
Right.
Just like they're not running back to their offices.
No. I think this is, it's going to be, to me, this is the beginning of a tremendously possibly creative moment in American Judaism. If leadership of all, not only congregations, but institutions, the denominations itself, if they understand that, as you say, there are now so many different access points, all of which are legitimate, The nature and before we close, I just want to push you one thing. I agree with you. I think we're creating a new American Judaism. It's not exportable to any place,
right?
But it's distinctly American. How concerned are you given these trends that we're picking up in the Pew reports with the Jews by the nones, N-O-N-E-S?
Right.
Do you think we're Do you think the future is potentially bright with people coming up following our generation who are going to look at Judaism in a very, very different way? Do you think when we get out of this pandemic, things are just going to try to ease back into the way it used to be?
I would answer it in a couple of ways. First of all, I'm very optimistic about the American Jewish future. I'm less optimistic about the future of American Jewish communal institutions, legacy institutions. Now, why do I say that? Well, for example, pre-pandemic, there were 600 startups in the Jewish community in the last 10 years. That's a lot of optimism. Many of those by younger people who didn't find a place in legacy institutions. So if we have sufficient adaptive leadership, then I think we can change and grow these institutions. If then we aren't able to do that, then many of these institutions will fail, and new ones, as befits the need, will rise up in order to take their place. That, I think, is the most important thing. The second thing, which is kind of what you were talking about before, we may use Zoom and we may use the term virtual to describe this kind of conversation, even the one you and I are having today. But since this is about sacred aging, if we were to ask our kids or our grandkids for sure, this isn't virtual at all. This is the way they live their lives. This is the way they communicate. And unless our communal institutions are willing to do those kinds of things as well, then they're not going to be able to compete in what's an open market economy for the Jewish community. And that, I think, is a recognition as well.
No, I always point out to people, and I'm sure you do with 7 grandchildren, just take a look at, you see people with little kids, 1-year-old kids, 2-year-old kids in a stroller, or when you would see them in the, you'd go to the mall. That little kid, they're playing with it. They understand it. They understand it intuitively. They don't have to be taught it. This is their this is the way they're processing many things. We need to get on that train. And I'm so the gift of Avi and Ahmed, once again, Avi and Ahmed play football in the park.
Jerusalem Sacher Park.
DixieBooks.com, and the other one,
TheBookDepository.com.
With the in there. Okay.
Right. And you can also, for those who search on the internet, there are other access points for it, but those are the two main ones.
Kerry, thank you very much for joining us. And
thank you.
Just much success and continued success with the writing. And it sounds like you're keeping busy. You're keeping busy.
I am indeed.
No, it's great. Enjoy the family, because I know you're blessed with another colleague of ours, and just stay healthy as we emerge out of this pandemic. And thank you very much. Take care.
Take care.
I appreciate your time. And to all of you, again, thank you for watching and listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast and TV show of Jewish Sacred Aging. Remember, the show is also now available on the streaming service called Roku. If you don't know what that is, ask one of your grandchildren. And again, we welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can email me, Rabbi Address, at JewishSacredAging.com. And don't forget to visit and like our Facebook page as well. And if you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help support this podcast and our work, please visit our website and click on the conveniently located donate button. Seekers of Meaning is produced at the Broadcast Center of Lubetkin Media Companies in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And we thank our producer, Steve Lubetkin. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Seekers of Meaning TV show and podcast. And until then, stay safe, everybody. Shalom.